The Guardian. This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that gives you the power of beautiful design. So you can do more than create a website, you can set yourself apart. To start your free trial, visit squarespace.com/guardian.
Hello, this is Politics Weekly. I'm Frances Perrodin. As the migrant crisis in Europe shows no sign of abating, can the EU get its act together before winter comes? Also this week, as left-wing parties are wiped out in the Polish elections, it's a different story in Portugal, where the left wins a majority of seats but is kept out of office. For now, at least. And as Britain's EU referendum campaign gathers pace, David Cameron rejects a Norwegian model as part of his renegotiation strategy. Joining me for all of this is Guardian data editor Alberto Nardelli, our correspondent in Warsaw, Alex Duval-Smith, and from the Open Europe think tank, Pavel Svidlicki. Welcome to all of you. The UN estimates that at least 700,000 migrants have arrived in Europe this year, and despite worsening conditions and colder temperatures, tens of thousands are still arriving every single week. I spent the early part of this week in the Greek island of Lesbos with the Liberal Democrat leader Tim Farron. I asked Farron, on a busy train from the airport, whether the trip had altered his perception of the crisis at all.
Maybe the numbers aren't a surprise to me, but when you actually see it in reality, and you see, we saw two camps, both, bursting at the seams, a real kind of sense of what the hardship means. One camp we saw, a simmering potential for trouble, real trouble, as different ethnic groups vie with each other. Some are ahead of the queue, the Syrians are at the head of the queue, others not, and yet their need might be just as great. I think you can only refer to as squalor and hardship. We experienced for ourselves the cold. We were sort of running around trying to get UNHCR on the phone to try and get a bunch of blankets. There was a particular family who'd arrived that day who'd experienced horrendous things, including seeing the boat behind them sink and six people die. They were cold, frankly. And as the weather gets worse, maybe the numbers won't turn off. Maybe they won't reduce. Maybe it'll just be poorer people with less cash taking their opportunity to be able to afford to get across. So, the poorest Syrians, the poorest people from Iraq and from Eritrea and places like that will take that opportunity and risk theirs and their children's lives in doing so, knowing, by the way, that it's still less of a risk than staying where they are.
And we know what the government's position on all of this is, what they've decided an appropriate plan of action is. Do you think they can be persuaded to do more?
Well, I am very cynical. I mean, I want to see the best in people. I am very cynical about the government's position because they haven't. They only settled on the view they have after, frankly, they were shamed into it by media and public campaign after the death of Aylin Kurdi and the picture of his body on the beach in Turkey. So 20,000 over 5 years is an awful lot better than what this government was doing. It is still shamefully low. It's a tiny scratch on the people who are in the camps. And, I suppose it struck home even more to me yesterday when I met the guy Selat and his wife Nadia, who were from Iraq, from an ISIS-controlled region of Iraq. Two little girls who were 5 and 3. It occurred to me that the one thing I couldn't say to those guys was they have any chance of having a place in the United Kingdom. And these are lovely people who just want to work hard and, people want to provide for their children in a place that's safe. And fundamentally, all the refugees after is safety. And we know, so none of those people I saw, we saw this last day or so, desperate people, resourceful people, self-reliant people, not one of them is the UK government planning to provide a home for. And that's pretty shameful.
Pavel, we've had a series of emergency summits, the latest called by Angela Merkel last Sunday, but where exactly are we in terms of a coordinated EU response?
Well, it's still not clear, actually. It seems like the EU response is changing. There's now a greater emphasis on controlling borders, on working with third countries and transit states, somewhat belatedly, but this is very welcome. We are still struggling to get the relocation scheme that was agreed last month underway. I've seen a range of numbers, but somewhere between 19 and 84 refugees out of the 160,000 have actually been relocated so far. So clearly a long way to go there. And also we've now seen countries like Germany and Sweden, who are actually going to be taking the bulk of these refugees, now saying, well, actually, they might actually need to redistribute some of their quota as well. So actually, we're still not really clear to having a coherent long-term response.
And Alex, we'll talk about Poland's election in more detail shortly, but on the specific issue of migration, how is Poland reacting to demands that it must take more refugees?
Poland's kept a very firm line on refugees. The country's very homogeneous and Catholic. There's been a strong lobby internally for those refugees who are accepted to be Christian. Having accepted initially 2,500 migrants, the figures up to about 7,000, but Polish politicians of the previous government put up a strong fight to keep the numbers down.
And Pavel, Angela Merkel famously offered a very warm welcome to Syrian refugees heading to Germany, but now it seems she might be paying a political price for that as more and more arrive. Is public opinion turning against her?
I think public opinion is slowly starting to change in Germany, and we're seeing the CDU-CSU support in the polls starting to drip a bit. That's now at around 34%, 35% having been around 40% previously. So certainly it's starting to have an effect. And the Alternative for Germany, which started its life as an anti-Euro party and which has now taken a very strong line on this refugee crisis, is starting to inch up. It's currently around 8%. So by no means is Germany completely gone against the refugee welcome policy of Angela Merkel, but it's starting to head that way. And obviously that's quite a concerning development.
And Alberto, Britain has, of course, opted out altogether of any intra-EU resettlement scheme. Where is UK public opinion on this issue right now?
In terms of British public opinion, I think clearly most people have very negative attitudes towards immigration in general, but also towards, I think, refugees specifically, because often the two issues are conflated. So, for example, when people are asked which is the biggest chunk of immigration coming to the UK, they believe that refugees is the largest share, when actually in reality it's the smallest. But I think more broadly, the bigger challenge is that you have here a challenge which should be approached by all European countries together, and you only have a very small number of countries, specifically Germany and Sweden, who are actually wanting to do what is required, while all other countries who are playing to a domestic crowd do not have the political courage to do what needs doing. And until you look at the refugee crisis comprehensively and globally, a solution will not be found. Because as Pavel said, you know, there are 160,000 who were meant to be redistributed and they're taking tens. And that's a tiny number if you look at in the context of the millions who have fled Syria, for example.
And is there opinion polling on whether or not the British public wants to take more refugees?
The British public does not want to take more refugees. And parts of that is because there is a belief in terms of the British public overestimates the number of refugees which Britain is already taking. But in general, even once those differences are explained, the British public still does not want to take more refugees. But I think that is the political challenge, is because most of Europe's political leaders are looking at the polls on this issue and at political convenience. That is why they're in such difficulties. There are some issues, I believe, where they should not look at the poll, because the issues are so great, and this is one of those issues.
And Alex, immigration was clearly a big issue in Poland's election. Now, as the results are in, can you tell us what happened last weekend?
We had an election which was for Parliament and for the Senate, and which saw the right-wing Law and Justice Party, which is the party of President Andrzej Duda, who was elected in May, gain an absolute majority in Parliament with a result of 37.5% of the vote, 13% ahead of the governing civil platform, which had been in power for 8 years. What has been one of the most remarkable phenomenons of this election is that Law and Justice have managed to break what is considered a kind of glass ceiling across Europe for far right parties, and that is that it has managed to gain cities, all the major cities. It's managed to win a very large youth vote, and it has broken down a traditional post-communist East-West divide in Poland, where you found in the past that the East was more conservative and the West was more, if you like, pro-EU. That has gone as well. So this sustained campaign in the last few years by Law and Justice, which resulted in first President Andrzej Duda being elected in May, and now a neo-conservative but national conservative party gaining power, is a significant development. Just as a rider, PSL, which is the only left-wing party to gain any seats in parliament, scraped in with 5.1% of the vote, i.e. just over the threshold to get into parliament.
And the Law and Justice Party aren't your typical right-wingers, though, are they?
Well, they have fought a campaign of strong Euro-conservatism, but also picking up on populist issues such as the low salaries that are perceived to be the problem in Poland. Poland has been a big winner from EU membership. The economy has been growing. It avoided any kind of recession during the Euro crisis. But nevertheless, Poles are unhappy with what they see as having been, if you like, they feel their country has been somewhat assailed by foreign brands, by foreign shops, by foreign businesses, helped by the EU to come here, and that the Polish business and that Polish workforce has suffered in many respects. Poles see their country as having become a bit of a German sweatshop, a sweatshop for, well, Germany is pointed at as being the villain because it's next door, but a sweatshop for the rest of the EU. And here, the fact that 2 million Poles are overseas working largely in the European Union, especially in the United Kingdom, is not a matter of national pride. It's seen to be a matter that reflects the poor salaries and conditions that continue to prevail here.
And Paweł, what on earth has happened to the Polish left?
Well, what happened was that parties of the self-defined left actually got about 11% of the vote. The problem was that both groups failed to cross their respective thresholds. So there was this thing called the United Left, which was about three or four parties, which included the traditional post-communist left, Social Liberal Party, the Polish Greens. And they got 7.5% of the vote, thereby not exceeding the 8% threshold that is necessary for electoral blocs. And then you also had this insurgent party modelled on Syriza in Greece and Podemos in Spain called Partia Razem, the Together Party, slightly ironically perhaps, given that they refused to join the United Left. And that party put on a very late surge, actually, and got about 3.5%, which was enough to deprive the United Left of seats and also not being sufficient for itself to win parliamentary representation. However, a lot of people are talking about the wipeout of the left in Poland. I would just say that both Law and Justice and the Kukiz movement, so this quite nationalist populist movement, have quite strongly welfareist protectionist economic policies. So in that sense, economically left policies will be even a majority in the parliament. And then with the election of this Nowoczesna party, you will still have an element of social liberalism. So I wouldn't quite say that the left is completely wiped out in Poland, although we have been reminded, if we needed it, that Poland is still quite a conservative country overall.
It's also a trend which has been happening for quite a while. Even at the last election, the Social Democrats got their worst result ever. So I think the, let's call it, more moderate left has been declining for quite a while in Poland now.
And in Portugal, the left did very well indeed. But since it's fragmented, the largest group is still the centre-right Forward Portugal Alliance, and the president has given them another chance to form a government. It's all fairly standard stuff, you'd think, but there are obviously Eurosceptics in this country and elsewhere who are calling it a coup. Why is that?
The reason is because they are trying to mislead the public. I think that, in a nutshell, is the reason why they're calling it a coup. I think no one in Portugal... What's funny about, if you look at the reaction in Portugal, you had papers that had, Twitter is saying that there's been a coup in Portugal, and thinking that people on Twitter were joking, and then they realised actually individuals like Daniel Hannan were not joking. They seriously thought that there had been a coup in Portugal. I think what's interesting is that if you look at what happened, independently of what the term that the president used, it is precedent in Portugal that the largest party gets the first go at forming a government. In 2009, the Socialist Party won the most votes, won the most seats, but did not have a majority, and the president gave them the mandate to form a government. The other point on the left, I think, is the left in Portugal, it's not a monolithic bloc. You have three very different parties. You have a socialist party, left wing, the left bloc, and then you have a communist party. And before the election, never did they say that they were going to work together. But I do think that what will happen is that if the current government, once it's formed, will not be able to govern, then it will be up to Parliament to see if there are alternative majorities, and if one of those alternative majorities ends up being a coalition of the various left parties, then that might be what happened. Then we can debate if it was right for the president to say what he said, but it's important to remember even the president in Portugal is an elected politician of a particular political party.
So, Pavel, not a coup or anything close to it, but it does raise the question, doesn't it, of how Europe might react to another Syriza-style movement gaining power in a heavily indebted EU country?
Well, exactly. I think there is a real risk that that with what's happening in the Eurozone at the moment, there is a risk that that national democracy is left somewhat hollowed out, where you can vote for different parties, but actually all the credible mainstream parties end up proposing very similar policies. I think that's a very genuine risk. And then when people just throw around accusations of a coup, which is demonstrably absurd, that actually risks undermining that very point. So I certainly agree with Alberto that's not a helpful portrayal of the situation, but it certainly does illustrate that there is still this risk that actually people who want to have a different Eurozone policy, but because you've got so many countries that would need to agree for a change of direction, you would need to change the treaties, that people end up getting fed up with that and just end up voting for parties like like Syriza in Greece and like the Communist Party in Portugal that promise simple solutions.
And Alex, finally on this, we've seen two very different anti-establishment votes this week in very different countries. Do you think the people on the streets of Lisbon have a similar sense of what the European Union is and what it's for as people in Warsaw?
Well, I can tell you about people in Warsaw, and I think one of the issues that is different here is that this being a very staunchly, devoutly Catholic country, there is a sense that Polish values have been somewhat undermined in the past few years since Poland joined the EU in 2004. Issues like abortion, IVF, gay rights are seen as being somewhat of a danger for Polish values. I think that's something that Law and Justice has really, that's the conservative side of Law and Justice that has appealed to Poles. And I think that's quite particular. But in terms of Poles' relationship with their wallets and with their governments, then the message that's coming from Poland is, yeah, we want more sovereignty, we want control over our salaries, we want to be winners in Europe at every level, not just in terms of big business. We want to feel the difference in our pockets. We want to be another Germany. We want to be another France. We want to be another UK if really we are winners in the EU. And Poles aren't feeling that.
Well, lastly this week, David Cameron has been in the Icelandic capital of Reykjavik, and he used his visit to take the fight to British Eurosceptics who favour a semi-detached status from the EU, similar to that of Iceland and Norway. Pavel, it seems a pretty strong case he has. If Britain wants to trade with the EU like Norway does, it has to play by its rules.
I think David Cameron is right to warn that the Norway model specifically would be very bad for the UK, because although it does have some advantages over full membership in the way that, in the sense that you're exempt from the agricultural policies and you can strike your own free trade deals, it is actually full EU membership in most other areas. And for example, if you're concerned about the cost of EU regulation on the UK economy, we've calculated that 93 of the 100 most burdensome EU regulations in force in the UK would also apply in the European Economic Area, which Norway is a part of. So in that sense, it's not really a good solution, especially as you would lose your formal voting rights over EU laws. I think, in fairness, very few people who want to leave the EU explicitly call for the Norway option by name. But what a lot of people do say is that after we leave, we will maintain unrestricted access to the single market. And really that is what the Norway option entails. So I think people who say, well, we would be able to have a completely different British option because of the size of our economy, that's possibly true. But there's no way of demonstrating that unless we actually vote to leave and try to negotiate that. So in that sense, it is a bit of a gamble. There is a degree of uncertainty, and that's what and I think that that'll be a key theme of the campaign.
And Alberto, as Pavel said, the main vote leave campaigns say they don't favour the Norway model. They think they can actually get much better terms. Are they deluded?
I think what's really interesting is for example, yesterday the US said that it does not do trade agreements with single countries and that it would not look at a deal just with the UK. I think the challenge that the campaign to leave has is that parts of the things that it talks about, so the Anglosphere as an economic idea, only exists in Daniel Hannan's head. It does not exist anywhere else. And the US position yesterday was very clear on this. I think Powell is absolutely right in the sense that lots of the things that they are talked about, so say, for example, controlling the free movement of people, you could only do that outside of the economic area. So lots of the things that they are talking about in any type of relationship that they would have with the EU, they would need to accept certain things which the side to leave doesn't want to accept. And all the alternatives that they talk about are simply not feasible.
And Alex, how does this all look from where you're sitting in Warsaw?
Well, I mean, I've been interested to follow the speculation in Britain that the arrival in power and the absolute majority here of the Law and Justice Party, which of course is part of the same grouping as the British Conservative parties in the European Parliament, that the Law and Justice's strengthened position will somehow be grist to the Brexit mill. But looking from here, it doesn't look like that. The Poles still need freedom of movement in Europe, and the feeling is here that even though Law and Justice has fought a very Eurosceptic campaign, or a fairly Eurosceptic campaign, in effect, Poland has got a large amount of money coming to it for the next 7 years from the EU, and it certainly needs the freedom for its citizens to move around in the EU. So really, it would not be of interest for Poland to see the UK leave the EU.
Well, that's all we have time for this week. My thanks to Pavel, Alex and Alberto. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Frances Peredin. Thanks very much for listening.
This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that gives you the power of beautiful design. So you can do more than create a website, you can set yourself apart. To start your free trial, visit squarespace.com/guardian.